The Y Curve with Phil Dobby and Roger Hearing.
Is Ukraine about to collapse?
The government in Kyiv say they're desperately short of weapons they need and were promised.
Is Europe's largest and longest war since 1945 about to present Vladimir Putin with a clear victory as the US Congress holds up vital arms supplies?
And does all this put Europe in a place of enormous danger? A position the Poland's Prime Minister says feels like 1939.
Has the West taken its eye off the ball, and could we all be the victims?
The Y Curve.
So, I mean, it does get down to, I mean, this shows the importance of America in all of in everything,
well,
doesn't it?
It's huge, and its support for Ukraine has been the dominant factor in everything that's happened so far.
And if they don't show that support, what happens? Does Europe then say, well, okay, we have to manage by ourselves? And America, I'm sure, will still happily sell weapons and armaments to us. We'll just have to pay for it all ourselves.
Which is a little more of a problem, And also, you've got all the political change coming in America. I mean, it's bad enough now. Who knows what happens if Donald Trump gets into the White House in November in terms of, or in January, because it will may well mean that the arms supplies and indeed political support for Ukraine dries up as well.
And he likes strong men. I mean, in his mind, he'll be going, well, here's a strong, with Putin, here's a strong man who's taking back control, and here's a man who used to be a comic actor. You know, I mean, that'll be his.
Well, you could, yes.
His view of the world. I mean, it's a very simplistic view of the world, but he's a man of
But is it all a moment of enormous peril for Europe? I mean, Donald Tusk, who's the Polish Prime Minister, has talked about 1939. This is what he says it is. And you know, all the implications of that, you know, that you have someone who is a strong leader, but may not stop necessarily at the border of Ukraine.
Scary. So what is he saying about that? Is he saying this is the start of World War III?
Well, effectively, yes, because he's saying that, you know, if you have a strong man who wants to expand in Europe, coming up against the borders of NATO now, potentially, if Ukraine collapses. So, perilous moment.
And he is, I mean, more of a border with NATO now, you know, because Finland is joining. You know, it's sort of like he's created a situation which might play to his benefit, of course.
It might.
All of a sudden he can say, well, look, the West is really against us. I mean, the Iron Curtain is back again, isn't it?
With but a vengeance. It also looks successful. That's the thing. He said he would take Ukraine if he does manage to. In a way, he's coming up with the goods, which in the end is what justifies the strong man image.
Isn't it bizarre that we are talking about, you know, a country that after the Soviet era became westernized. You know, people were welcoming McDonald's restaurants as though that was actually the good of the West. I mean, actually, that's it's rather sad if that's what these actually see as one of the benefits of being westernized. But and all of a sudden, that's flipped on the head. And I wonder now whether the average person in Russia is very anti-West as a result of all of this.
Very possibly, but I think what they remember is the chaos that came after the end of the Soviet period and how awful that was. And so, you know, in a way, strength is what they're after. But will that then have a knock-on effect of putting Europe in grave peril, which is certainly the suggestion of many who form that border? Well, let's talk to someone who knows about this in some detail. David Galbraith, he's the Professor of War and Technology at the University of Bath, and he joins us now.
So, David, I mean, you go into a war to win, obviously. Who's going to win this one?
I think it's really hard to tell. I think that if you look at the literature in terms of the way that wars have been studied, in terms of the way that they win or who wins, it's really a complex picture. I mean, the correlates of war study that has been done really since almost the end of the 1960s has looked at all the different correlates or variables of war to suggest that actually it can be about resources, it can be about allied help, it can be about whether or not you're targeting civilians or not. It could be about the morale of your troops and things like this. And we know that actually those things really are a problem on both sides, actually, although of different degrees in different areas. And so it's really difficult to say at this moment what it's likely to be. What we do know is that Russia has a longer, in a sense, kind of set of resources, whether that be people or whether that be in the ability to produce armaments or the ability to produce missiles, not to mention that it continues to get support for others, unlike Ukraine at the moment, which seems to be struggling. So that is something to keep in mind.
Well, yeah, and clearly that is the issue of the moment, that Ukraine appears to be being starved of resources. And very interestingly, Donald Tusk, the Polish Prime Minister, really making a point about the danger of this moment. I mean, he talked about 1939, the equivalence. If Ukraine loses, the implications for Europe. So I suppose if we disentangle that, Is it a lack of resources in the end that's going to decide the outcome of this? Is there a feeling that within the next 6 months to a year, potentially, Ukraine could collapse because it simply doesn't have enough weapons?
I think that's it's really difficult, actually, because what we see in many cases. So at the moment, Ukraine and Russia are really fighting each other like for like. And that means that actually, when it comes to missiles and drones and trenches and tanks and soon to be, more aircraft, that actually, you know, they're really, in a sense, facing each other the same way. But if you think back to the way that the Taliban fought NATO and American forces, they didn't try to fight American forces or NATO forces in that way. They actually sought to do it through an insurgency. And we could easily imagine that the Ukrainian situation will, in a sense, kind of move towards much more of an insurgency should that sort of resource start to dry up. That means that actually the type of resources that they need really are totally different. And it comes down to the in many cases, the things that we did see in Afghanistan and Iraq, for that matter, and also that we saw in Vietnam and Indonesia and other places where we've had large scale insurgencies.
This is a Russian insurgency that you're talking about.
That's an insurgency against Russian forces, because we imagine that Russia will continue to try to fight the war that it wants to fight. And that means that it has, you know, at its disposal artillery, heavy artillery, missiles, the ability to target really, in the sense, you know, far west of Ukraine, even overflying in a sense, as we saw in the case of Poland most recently. So we suspect that Russia will continue to want to fight that way. The question comes is whether or not Ukraine can continue to fight that way. If we do see a continued blockage of American parts predominantly, although that we do see continued supply of weapons from European and also other Asian nations. I mean, think of South Korea in particular as sending quite a few weapons, especially individual held anti-tank and anti-aircraft, what are referred to as TOWS and man pads, in fact. So there are, in a sense, there are things that are continually changing, but we could imagine that Ukraine itself could transition much more towards what's referred to as a punishment phase rather than this kind of this kind of attrition phase that we see.
But if that happened, Dave, is effectively what you're saying is there could be a breakdown in the front line, so the Russian forces can push through, push west, perhaps even take Kyiv, and then the Ukrainian resistance goes into this insurgency phase beneath the surface. I mean, that is going to be a very dramatic moment in the war if that happens.
Yeah, it could be a dramatic situation. I mean, the question, if you're Ukrainian, though, is you ask yourself, do we, in a sense, you know, where do we see our strategic, future being? Do we think that we're going to be able to fight them in the way that they're fighting us? Or do we imagine that they're going to overrun us if we continue like this? So why don't we melt into the scenery and just come out and punish them? And of course, that's very effective. We do see that the defender in an insurgency always has the advantage. And that's something that maybe they would like to play to their part. Now, you're absolutely right. That is politically very problematic, both for the continued support in some quarters for Kyiv, but for others. I mean, Poland is a good example. Poland would be, in a sense, considerably even more heightened should we imagine that the big cities of central and western Ukraine were to fall to Russian forces. What we do know is that these kind of insurgencies are really punishing for occupying militaries. And we've seen some of that in the early days of Russian forces as they fought to take Kyiv before. But we, you know, it would be a huge change in the war. I do accept that.
And what is the response going to be from America if that happens? Are they going to go, well, actually, this isn't our war, so we'll just, if Donald Trump is president, does he just accept it? And what's the reaction in Europe? I mean, Europe is not going to be happy to see Russia seen as being the taking ground and being the winning force, or at least, you know, heading in that direction. I mean, that's unthinkable, isn't it? Unfathomable for all of Europe.
Well, I think that, you know, you have to consider, you know, what are the alternatives? The alternatives are a complete Russian victory. And you know, if things were to, in a sense, to go terribly for the Russians in terms of continued supply, so I think that we imagine that life is going to be difficult for Ukraine under a Trump presidency, regardless. I think Trump very much sees that that the you know the best way to get the Russians out of Ukraine is to actually gift Ukraine to the Russians. Now that doesn't make sense to me. It may not make sense to many of your listeners, but I would say that actually there's a
I think
large
they make sense to one man, I think.
Well, possibly two men, Trump possibly and Putin.
yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's a feeling that actually that Trump doesn't really have an interest in maintaining any of these. You know, he sees this as an extension of NATO, which he's very highly skeptical of in the first place. He sees this as an extension of interest of Europeans, which he's very highly skeptical of. So there's a feeling that actually that Ukraine really kind of drags the United States in a direction that Trump doesn't want it to go. And partly that means, in a sense, kind of coming up against Putin, and he's shown time and time his admiration for Vladimir Putin, but I believe that Trump has a different interest at heart, much more in the sense anti-Chinese. Although Biden has largely taken that, you know, taken that ground too. So there's not really a lot that kind of distinguishes them as far as that's concerned. If we do see another Biden administration, that will also be interesting because we do know that Biden is under a considerable pressure, both to constrain, say, for instance, its weapon supplies to Israel. And quite often, what he's been able to do is use this kind of policy linkage between Israel and Ukraine as a way to continue to fund Ukraine. And we do see that actually that this is starting to break down as the question of Israel and its support continues to break down,
We're
especially
in a
amongst
very, very
the party.
difficult and complicated interface of all these various crises, of course. But I suppose one of the things that the Europeans are thinking about, and one thing we wanted to address in this, David, is what about if Vladimir Putin is successful? How much of a threat to the rest of Europe would he then become? Because the implication has always been if the Ukraine isn't where he's going to stop. There isn't an end to this. He is looking towards NATO members, potentially Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, the Baltics, which historically had been within the Soviet Union quite recently. And that, you know, perhaps it is that 1939 moment that Donald Tusk was talking about. Do you think that is a possibility?
Of course, it's a possibility. Do I think it's likely? No, I don't. I don't think it's likely because I think that actually Russia is very conscious, or the Kremlin is very conscious of the punishment that it's received. A huge number of casualties have come out of Ukraine. A huge amount of resources has gone into Ukraine. We've seen the rise of the first, in a sense, popular revolt during the Ukraine war. And what we imagine actually is that Ukraine is, I mean, Ukraine seems to be what primarily the Russians are very interested in. And I would say, if you've been looking at Ukraine for the last 20 years, and I have been for a variety of different reasons in my own research, what I would say is that you see that Russia has always been very conscious and agitated by any pro-Western government that comes into Kyiv. Now, early Russian Ukrainian presidents were really, in a sense, able to balance between Russia and the European Union or Europeanization much more so. But that really ended in 2004. And the feeling that actually that happened then was that Ukraine could be the underbelly of Russia itself and the undoing of the Putin administration. So that's why there is such this focus on Ukraine. What I would say is that going into a NATO member state, whether that's Estonia, you know, one of the smallest NATO member states, or something much larger like Poland or Romania, really is a totally different kind of scale of things. One, this is that both the EU, in terms of their own treaty of the European Union, but also NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty, both require a military response should one of their members be invaded. That's a much more significant response than anything that Ukraine has ever been promised.
They're much more black and white, isn't it? But I mean, it's the difference is slightly nuanced, isn't it? In that, okay, we don't have troops on the ground in Ukraine, but everyone is supplying weaponry, armaments. I mean, we have volunteers, not sanctioned by states, but, you know, there's people going in there as well. He is fighting a war against the West.
I think he doesn't see it as fighting a war against the West. I think that actually Vladimir Putin sees it very much. Now, there could be others in his administration who see it differently, but I think Vladimir Putin really sees it as a war for Russia. And the West is in there somewhere, but more than anything else about securing Russia. And he thinks, rightly or wrongly, that Ukraine, a friendly government in Ukraine, is the best way to ensure a secure Russia. I don't think that I'm not trying to apologize or anything like that, because I think that there's a problem in that thinking. But what I would say is that, you know, if you look at the way that in 2014, when the initial invasion happened in Ukraine, you saw a radically different type of Ukrainian army or military, which actually they've had to professionalize really quickly during that time. But by the time that 2022 came, you still had, in a sense, not really a modern army or modern military in the way that we would understand it. Now you look at Poland, or you look at Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Germany, not to mention the UK and the United States and Canada and others, then you're actually talking about a wholly different type of military that the Russians would have to be facing.
But further to your point,
which comes with a huge... Sorry.
So I was just going to say, but further to your point, yes, I take on board that, you know, these are different sorts of forces, and it's a very different thing to take on NATO. The, you know, potential for invoking the article of the NATO treaty, what attack on one is attack on all and all that. But we're talking an era of asymmetric warfare, and you mentioned insurgency. Of course, that was how it all began in the eastern parts of Ukraine. Would it not be possible to imagine the threat would not be in terms of battalions and tanks, but in terms of cyber warfare, in terms of minor insurgency stirring up ethnic groups in a way that NATO probably couldn't have?
It's something that NATO has been very conscious of really for a long time. If you think of the Bronze Soldier incident in Estonia in 2008.
Just remind us of that.
You'll remember that the Estonians sought to move a bronze Soviet soldier from...
It's a war memorial, wasn't it?
It's essentially, yeah, it was a memorial, but it was essentially sitting at a bus stop. And they wanted to move it essentially to a park where many other statues are, some of them Soviet, but some of them not Soviet. And the idea was that it would be, in a sense, more honored than just being, in a sense, on a bus stop. But there was a feeling that this was an insult to the Russian speakers, or those who sacrificed themselves in the Second Great Patriotic War, which we considered to be the Second World War. And what happened in Estonia was that Russians basically did these DDoS attacks, denial of service attacks, against the banks and newspapers and everything else. So really, really shut down Estonia's its internet. This meant that actually the result of that was a huge amount of focus. The NATO Cyber Command is located in Estonia, for instance, a huge amount of focus on securing our banks and our critically secure infrastructure against a potential Russian hack in the future. That is particularly difficult, especially, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing. So, or a cat and mouse thing, rather, as much as the Russians try to do something, NATO tries to defend, and the Russians try to advance, and so does the West, and so on. So there is in a sense, a constant tit for tat. But the feeling is that actually NATO and the EU, for that matter, and in addition, organizations like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and even the Council of Europe, all of these organizations have been very conscious of the ethnic tensions that exist in these spaces, and also the vulnerabilities that are being created through something like cyber.
So the ethnic tensions are supposedly what started all of this, isn't it? That it was the Russian-speaking people within Ukraine that he was saying, you know, when the boundaries were drawn up, they woke up one morning and all of a sudden they were no longer in Russia. And that's what he wants to take back. There must be other parts of the world, other boundaries, that he could level that
well,
same
certainly
argument
in Estonia
against.
There would be.
Would be. Yeah. Wait. So what makes us think that, you know, he's not going to say, well, okay, for the same logic, he's going to go further.
Well, just let me say that you know, if he said that, he would be wrong, because actually Ukraine was a Soviet socialist republic and not part of the Russian Soviet Federalist Republic prior.
But his point was that there are Russian speakers. Mind you, there are.
There's a long history, David, of Russia thinking of Ukraine as part of its heartland, though, despite the Soviet-era divisions, no?
I think so. It's more a historiography than a history, because many have, many of Russia has ignored Ukraine altogether and just understood it to be, in a sense, kind of like, you know, the rural heartland of a place, but really not the center of Russian culture. Needless to say, I think there is a there are occasions where it does come back into Russian national image, if you will. But let me, in a sense, say that actually what Russia did was a classic part of its playbook. What it sought to do in places like Georgia and Abkhazia and South Ossetia is it sought to challenge the German state, I mean, the Georgian state, rather, largely through this kind of on-again, off-again conflict in order to protect what it saw as Russian speakers in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And traditionally, Abkhazia and South Ossetia had been at one point in time part of Russia, but had been given to the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic prior. And so the feeling was that it was using the language of Russian or Rusini, this notion of Russians being, in a sense, somehow ethnic Russians being something that the Russians had to protect. Now, this is not, you know, particular to Russians. You know, Hungary has been talking about this and uses this on a regular basis of, you know, what Greater Hungary used to be and where Hungarians sit today, et cetera. But what we do see that in Transnistria, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, that there was a feeling that actually Russia could continue to use this on again, off again. Now, the feeling was that this is exactly what he was trying to do in Donetsk and Lugansk in the east. Crimea is a little bit of a separate thing, I would suggest to you. Crimea is, in a sense, understood to be Russian. You did have a lot of Russian sympathies. Traditionally, the Black Sea Fleet, Russian Black Sea Fleet, was in Crimea all along since the end of the Soviet Union. So nothing had changed there. I had been, for instance, at a NATO conference in Crimea, in Yalta, back in 2012, I believe it was, and no hotel wanted to take a NATO conference even at that time. And it's not mm-hmm. because there was a feeling of, you know, that something was about to happen. It was more the idea that there's just a lot of pro-Russian feeling in that space. I think Donetsk and Lugansk are, in a sense, a separate issue. I think that actually not a lot of Donetsk or Lugansk, not a lot of these kind of Donbass Ukrainians were really seeking to be Russian. They may speak Russian as their native language. They may, maybe they don't speak Ukrainian at all, because why would you need to in the East? But the feeling is that if you think that actually you're a wealthy businessman in the East, wait until these Russian oligarchs get a hold of you. And there's a paper that myself and Tatiana Malyurenko wrote in the early 2000s, really about this issue, is that the one thing that really is stopping, in a sense, a real kind of push for the oligarchs in eastern Ukraine really to push for a kind of a Russian solution for the East would be this idea that actually the amount of wealth and control and the power dynamics in Russia are not something that actually anybody wants to invite into Ukraine
itself.
They
might get out-oligarched, I suppose, would be a way of
exactly.
But I suppose,
and that's exactly how.
Yeah, I was just going to say, David, so that's the situation, as you say, with regard to a number of debatable territories, you might say. But with regard to, say, Estonia, just this idea that if following some sort of Russian victory in Ukraine, they then had a face-to-face border with NATO in areas they hadn't before, and potentially there could be these tensions, certainly in Estonia, there are Russian speakers there, they could be stirred up, and this could be a way of Vladimir Putin keeping that whole border area very much in play with an eye potentially to future expansion.
Well, firstly, I'd like to say thank you for bringing up my PhD, which I wrote in 20 years ago. Because
Delighted. We always like to promote things here.
This is exactly what I wrote on at this point in time. Unfortunately, at that time, everybody thought that actually nobody cares about these Russian speakers any longer. But it's really come back into the fore, I think, in terms of it being an important issue. One thing has really happened in both Estonia and Latvia, which traditionally does have quite sizable Russian citizens and parts of the country that are predominantly Russian speaking, is that in the 1990s, there was a huge push towards really what you could call assimilation or integration or things like this, where they changed names. So if your name was something like Relkov or something like that, in Latvia you became a Relkovs, and so you had an S if you were a man, or an A if you were a woman, put at the end of your name, even if that wasn't your traditional Russian name. All in 1998, all Russian children and all children in Latvia and Estonia, they had to start learning Estonian or Latvian in those countries. Now, as someone who's tried to study both Estonian and Latvian, I can tell you that actually, if a Russian speaker learning Latvian is a lot different than a Russian trying to learn Estonian, which is a totally different language, and where at least Latvian is still an Indo-European language like Russian. And so there was a feeling that actually, that if you think about 1998, where you had 40% still being taught in their target language, I mean, in their original languages, so Russian or Ukrainian or Belarusian, which you did have in those schools, where there were those minorities. But what you did start to see is that really we're talking about almost 24 years on, you can see that actually generations have grown up. Now, two generations have grown up, largely having an excellent command of those titular languages like Estonian and Latvian. And
so you'd say the tension has eased then? It's not as much of an issue as it was?
Absolutely. And some of the work that we did and myself and an academic, Richard Rose, did in the late 2000s was looking at these identities. And what we found was really interesting. If you asked them whether they found themselves to be, if you interviewed, say, a Russian in Daugavpils, for instance, a Russian speaker in Daugavpils, and you said, which is in Latvia, if you asked them, do you feel Russian or Latvian? They would say, I feel Russian. If you said, okay, take that into mind, do you feel, in a sense, Baltic Russian or Russian, they would say almost 100% of the time, Baltic Russian. And then they would give you an example of why they are not like the Russians. They are different. They are civilized. They are Western. They are all these things. They are not these kind of crazy Russians as they saw it. And of course, there's a bit of imagery and so on being used there. And maybe that is, in a sense, part of the local or the national language about, our unstable neighbors. But there's really a feeling that there's not a space or an opportunity for Russia. But what I would say is I don't think there was in Ukraine either, but the Russians did it anyway. Yeah. And then that's what they called it.
So how has being Russian changed? Because it seems like he is carrying the people. I mean, we get that impression, although it's very difficult to tell, obviously, because, the truth and war are very different things. But it seems like he is carrying the people of Russia behind
Putin
him.
Putin can really claim, wrap himself in the flag and say that he is genuinely pushing forward in Russian identity.
And upping military spending. And, of course, if it looks like they're going to have more countries that are going to be NATO countries on their border, then all the more reason for him to up spending even further. So it plays into his hands. Yeah, absolutely. A big support for him. I mean, this is strengthening his position, isn't it?
It is, and I think it is strengthening his position, but I would say that it's probably strengthening his position in the short, medium term. I think what we see nearly in all of our experiences of going to war in the last 20 years or even 30 years, thinking of Bosnia or Kosovo, is that it doesn't matter, actually, when your government decides to send your military off to war, there is what's called a rally around the flag effect. And Putin still seems to be benefiting from this. I think a lot of people think, I thought that maybe Iraq doesn't make sense for the United States and the United Kingdom in 2003. But what I wanted to do is for our, men and women of the armed forces who go to Iraq to make sure that they're safe and they do a good job and all these things. So, you see these, in a sense, kind of contradictory feelings in many Russians, where they don't want to see the killing of Russian soldiers. They don't want to see Russian soldiers dying on television. They don't want to hear about the losses or anything like that. They want their, largely sons to come home safe and having done a good job. And if Putin tells us that, the heart and the future of Russia is staked into the, the control of Ukraine, then by all means, let's support that happen. What we find is that's really the case for nearly every country who goes to war in the short to medium term.
Is anti-Western sentiment a residual effect out of all this? Iraq, of course, if you ask anybody now, you'd find very few supporters of the Iraq war, wouldn't you? But
no, that's right. And you see the cracks starting to happen in Russian society, too, where there is a growing feeling that actually, and much in the way of the Soviet period, where you talk about doublespeak. So, if somebody asks you on the news, if national news comes and interviews you and say, what do you think about the war? You say, it's great war. My great leader, Vladimir Putin and all these things. But what you do say around the dinner table or with friends is different, and you start to see this type of doublespeak growing. We did see
Russians are very used to this, of course, historically.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, what we don't know is really what the underlying support for the war really is. But what I would suggest to you that actually that Putin and the security apparatus that is created around Russia means that it doesn't really matter.
Himself anyway.
Yeah, the Russian population could be totally against the war in Ukraine, and Russia, and Vladimir Putin could continue to prosecute it. And that's because it does have complete control over Russia.
I wonder whether Tusk's comment about 1939, part of that is that it is dividing the world and has the potential to divide the world even further. Even to the point, so you've got to pick a side. There'll be countries within Asia that are picking a side, and even between Europe and the United States. So if Donald Trump says, we're not going to spend any more money on this, then Europe is going to say, we are. That puts a big question mark over the future of NATO.
And the future of the European Union, because it will come down to that as much as NATO, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really hard thing to imagine, because we just got... we don't have the ability to manufacture weapons at a rate that would mean that we would go to war with a major power like Russia. And that's something that actually you would need a huge amount of investment from governments, either collectively through something like the EU or individually, that we don't have at the moment. And who is going to come into office and say what we should do is spend less on the NHS and schools so that we can increase the amount of defense infrastructure and industry? It's hard to imagine where that's going to happen. And
certainly hard to imagine with a potentially incoming Labour administration, I think, too. But as we draw this to a close, Debbie, just a sense then, do you feel that we are at a moment of crisis in this war? Is it likely to change radically, do you think, within the next 12 months, or are we going to be at this time next year still scratching our heads and saying, this is a horrible stalemate, lots of people dying, but not much changing?
I think that you can really see Donald Tusk's comments in two ways. I think you can see it very much in his case of trying to, in a sense, use imagery that hopefully gets some kind of response. And so he's drawing something that he thinks that people remember in some way or another. And so let's do something, because we don't want to make the mistake of Nazi Germany once again, who tried to run over Europe in the same way that Napoleon did. Let's stop this before it happens. On the other hand, the idea that 1939 really is likely to happen is probably unlikely. What we do, in a sense, could understand 1939 as a warning being, is that actually what we do see in Russia and in China and in India and in Brazil and others is this idea of trying to redraw the post-war consensus that we had after the end of the Second World War. And that those really are the rules of the game of world politics. And really, we can see that there's a concerted effort to try to undermine those rules. And it's really hard to imagine how that's not going to happen, especially as we see continued strife coming between U.S. presidents of a certain variety and European politicians, certain varieties. And so there's going to be, in a sense, it's going to be really difficult for the West to get its head around the idea that the world is going to look different in the future in some way or another. And I would suggest that actually there is a growing change. Now, whether or not that's a crisis, I mean, a crisis is a politically manufactured thing. I don't know whether it's a crisis or not, but it's definitely something that's happening.
But Russian troops in Kyiv would be seen as a crisis, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely for the West, it would be seen as a crisis. And I don't think anybody wants to see that, really. I don't think that actually a lot of Republicans in the United States want to see it either. I think that actually what Donald Trump wants is really hard to determine in many cases. So,
In most cases, on anything, yeah. Really.
Exactly.
David, we're going to have to pull it to a close there, but thank you so much for talking to us. Really appreciate it. And, well, who knows, maybe this time next year we will be talking to each other again. And
about the same thing.
In a similar
still
thing, but we will see. Yeah. Or maybe we'll have moved into 1940 by then. Who knows?
I would be happy to come back.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks, good David. To talk to you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's enough war for now.
Yes.
Next.
Hopefully forever.
So what else do we talk about? We talk about war, economics, we talk about that.
We do. And growth.
And growth, yeah.
Which is what they keep talking about. We need more growth in the UK economy, in the global economy,
and
the
European
economy.
That's the question, isn't it? I mean, actually, if we've got this issue that we're addressing climate change, and there seems to be this belief in some quarters that we can address climate change while enjoying growth.
Well, that is the great difficulty.
Yeah.
Can it be done? Can you actually increase the size of your economy without also putting the very future of our existence at even greater peril?
So it seems to go against the laws of physics a little bit, doesn't it?
It does, but some leading thinkers are saying now there are ways of doing it. There are ways of shaping our growth, getting growth, but also having it in a particular shape that means that we won't damage the environment, or at least not in the ways we think.
So, or do we, it's a question, or do we need growth at all? How do we measure the success of a country? Because we've always relied on gross domestic product, GDP, as a measure of how well a country is doing. I mean, there have been, attempts in the past to say, well, that's the wrong measure.
Yeah.
We should really be looking at how happy people are. I mean, if you've got a great deal of GDP growth, but a whole load of miserable people, really, what is the point?
If you can't measure GDP, you've got a really big task if you try and measure happiness, quite honestly.
Well, yeah.
But it's a little bit more subjective. But we will pursue all this. We will talk about next week, hopefully, whether you can actually grow an economy, make people prosperous without also putting everything else in peril.
Yeah. Okay. That's next week on The Y Curve. Join us for that, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
The Y Curve.